This edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on the 12th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show in association with Mubi.
I love the love scene. It's very good.
Well, that's because they're not always telling each other how much in love they are. A good love scene should be about something else beside love. For instance, this one. Me fixing grapefruit, you sitting over there dopey, half asleep. Anyone looking at us could tell we were in love.
It was a time beginning somewhere in the late 1930s when Hollywood pictures began to take a decidedly dark turn. Spurred by the paranoia of an America at war and the arrival of European filmmakers, pulpy detective potboilers took on a genre all of their own, and the classic film noir era was born.
It has been seen as almost a completely American phenomenon for so long, but now we know that the British did their version of film noir, the Japanese did theirs, the Italians had film noir. We're rethinking a lot of our ideas about who is inspiring who and where did all this stuff come from.
Plus, which of the world's cities best epitomizes the noir aesthetic? Los Angeles, perhaps, or maybe San Francisco? Well, how about Vienna?
It is a film shot in the partly destroyed city a few years after the World War. And you can see in this film Vienna as it was and you will never see again.
That's all to come on a special film noir edition of The Cinema Show in association with Mubi on Monocle 24. So, welcome to the show. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Midori House in London. And as we just mentioned, this week's show is peering through the Venetian blinds at the richly subversive genre of film noir. But before we get to that, I want to talk to you about a closely related topic that ought to be at the heart of any cinema enthusiast. In the age of online streaming, it's tempting to think that the availability of films is better than ever. What once required masses of physical storage space, cluttered with reels of film, now takes the form of a few terabytes. But somehow, in the maddening race to discover the next big thing, the art of discovery is often forgotten. We all know that films like Citizen Kane and Vertigo are among the best cinematic visions ever created, and they'll quite rightly last forever. But our system of mainstream appreciation of film history depends largely on titles being deemed relevant by a select few. Let's consider that, of the roughly 11,000 silent films made in America between 1912 and 1930, around 70% have been lost forever. Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation expands on that, claiming that half of all American films made before 1950 are lost. Now, the rise of home entertainment and cable television in the 1980s helped ignite a renewed enthusiasm for older movies. Titles that once became mere liabilities after their initial run in the cinema now retained a form of commercial value. Just think about all that revenue generated by the eternal screenings of The Wizard of Oz or The Sound of Music. The ability to stream movies is undoubtedly one of the greatest things to happen for anyone who appreciates access to quality cinema. But embracing the future should not come at the expense of losing interest in the past. Valuing cinema is about more than distribution incomes. It demands seeing the medium as an art form, worthy of all the appreciation and celebration that we devote to anything housed in the Guggenheim or the Tate Britain. Technology provides us with vital tools, but the will to use them wisely can be slightly harder to come by. Well, that's where my guest today comes in. As a former print journalist, Eddie Muller has long enjoyed an appreciation, or shall we say obsession, for the darker side of American cinema. He's the author of several books, many of which deal specifically with the genre of film noir. And he's also spearheaded the revival of some tragically neglected titles once in danger of meeting a similar fate to those 11,000 lost titles that we mentioned earlier. He joins me now from Monocle's New York Bureau, Eddie Miller. I am thrilled to welcome you to the cinema show today. We'll discuss some key noir titles soon, but first, I want to hear some of your thoughts first about just the concept of film preservation in general, because I know that is a topic that you're quite passionate about. And I think it is something that's so often misunderstood as well, because this concept of preserving films for future generations, it's really about far more than just wanting some of your personal favourites to stick around, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I had no idea that this is something I would be getting into. It seemed to me when I began getting into this, like, well, isn't everything going to be saved? Because now, you know, we have all this digital technology and everything's on a DVD or something, that there was nothing to save. And boy, did I get an education. Because now we've just learned that there's so much stuff out there that isn't surviving what I call the triage, that there are films that are just going to be lost to the next generation, and they won't have the opportunity to discover them in the way that I did when I was younger. And it's amazing to realize that as the convenience of this digital age increases, it also whittles down your options for what you actually get to view.
Well, it is something that I touched upon there in the introduction, but I think this element of rediscovery is something that we really don't take all that seriously today. There's an assumption, I think, running thick, for example, that we know all about the silent era's most important titles, and that's all there is to it. But, I mean, we only need to look at someone like Louise Brooks as an example. She's an iconic actress for sure now, but she quite likely would have been forgotten forever had it not been for a few French critics of the 1950s who proclaimed her an icon on par with Greta Garbo or Marlene Dietrich. And now, had it not been for the George Eastman House in New York, the Louise Brooks that we know today may not have been possible. I think that really speaks to the core of what film preservation is really all about, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Not coincidentally, I'm speaking to you from New York, where I'm about to present a film series at the Museum of Modern Art that is resurrected Argentine film noir from the immediate post-World War II era. And these are films that no one in this country has even seen. And there aren't as many people out there digging through vaults and far-flung locales to find new material that changes the discussion entirely. And it's kind of fascinating. And this is something, in terms of film noir, this is something that I think is really critical and very important, because it has been seen as almost a completely American phenomenon for so long. Obviously, there's a French aspect to it, but now we know that the British did their version of film noir, the Japanese did theirs, the Italians had film noir, South America had its film noir, and it's kind of, we're rethinking a lot of our ideas about who is inspiring who and where did all this stuff come from.
Well, we could discuss the virtues of film preservation all day, which would thrill me, I do have to confess. However, we do have some absolutely magnificent noir titles to discuss today. So I'd like to start with what's often hailed as the greatest performance ever by the greatest American film actor ever, that being Humphrey Bogart in the masterpiece In a Lonely Place.
Dix, Brody wants me for the part of Althea. I'm going to read the script tonight.
Whose script?
Yours, genius. He's going to send it to my house. That is, if he likes it.
Did he tell you where he got my script?
I took it to him, thanks. This morning. I stole it out of Laurel's desk.
No, he didn't. I gave it to him.
Brody's been so impatient.
I'm sorry, Mel. I always put my foot into it.
Don't be angry, Dix. I know Brody will love it.
Oh, I don't blame you, but Mel should have known better.
Why don't I keep my big mouth shut?
Is there a juicy part in it for me?
Did you read it?
No.
You're lying. You read it and you didn't like it.
Oh, what does it matter what I think? I'm the guy that tried to talk Selznick out of doing Gone with the Wind.
What's wrong with my script?
Nothing, but it's not the book. And that's what Brody asked for, a faithful adaptation.
The book was trash, and you're a thief.
Dix, please.
Now, Eddie, if you're a newcomer to the world of film noir, this film will probably put you on an unexpected sidetrack. It is a noir for sure, but it's also a sleeping beast all of its own. This 1950 work by director Nicholas Ray came towards the end of the noir age, when appetites for the darker side of post-war American culture were well established. Bogart plays Dixon Steele, a screenwriter in Los Angeles who may or may not have something to do with the grisly murder of a beautiful young waitress with whom he spent a slightly unusual evening. And good news for movie subscribers here in the UK, you can catch this film playing right now. Eddie, those familiar with the Bogart legacy will probably find this film quite a shock, won't they?
Well, they will because, you know, he doesn't have a gun. He's not really playing a tough guy or any of that. But interestingly, this is the closest to himself that Bogart ever got on the screen. I call it his most self-revelatory performance, and I've said that to his own son, Stephen Bogart, who didn't disagree. This really is Bogart playing someone very much like himself. But the thing I love about this film is it does use the spine of a noir story. Like, is this guy guilty or not? And how did this young woman end up dead in the canyon and all this? But it quickly delves into much deeper, much more adult terrain, which is why I find it so thrilling. And I remember seeing this movie when I was 17 or 18 years old, and I just knew immediately that this was something very, very significant and also quite a cautionary tale. When you're a young person heading into adulthood and you think you have ideas about what that means, this movie stuck with me for years. And still to this day, every time I watch it, I sort of glean something new and very significant from its depiction of how people can destroy themselves and not know what the best thing is for them. And it is a remarkable film. I'm glad that you appreciate it so much.
Indeed. And I mean, there are so many reasons to appreciate this film, even just the way it really gets its message across, because it does come across as you say, it's a bit of a blend of different genres, although it does use the noir spine, as you put it, quite significantly. But there's also quite a bit of expressionism in the way that it depicts the scenes. There's a wonderful moment with Humphrey Bogart's character sitting down on a chair when he's at dinner with two of his friends. And just for a moment, when he becomes quite dark in his message, all of the lights around him dim just slightly, and there's a small spotlight just on his face. And it's relatively subtle, but it is very noticeable at the same time. And there's also another moment in the film where we get to see a crime scene photo of the young woman that is murdered. And we actually get the full picture peering over the shoulder of one of the characters. It's quite a graphic picture to put in a film, especially for this era. Do you think that that says something about the way the director Nicholas Ray was trying to portray what's happening in the film?
Absolutely. Yeah, he does use a few expressionist techniques along the way. What I love about this, though, is how he depicts the character of a writer or an artist, if you will, and how they stand apart from other people in society. Because in both of those instances that you're describing, people are surprised at how little emotional reaction Bogart has to the stuff that he's seeing. Or when he tells that tale and he assumes the role of the murderer, how quickly he comes out of it and says, well, you know, I'm just making all that up. You can believe me or not. I just tell my story really effectively. And that had a great impact on me when I was young, because I said, oh, this is something that people actually do, you know. He reacts to life differently than other people because he's an artist, because he absorbs all this stuff and then figures out how to retell the tale in a more effective way. There's a beautiful line in the movie, which to me sort of informs everything about movies and writing and everything. And they said, well, you know, it's his story against mine, but of course, I told my story better. And that could be just a writer talking, or that could be a killer explaining away, you know, how I'm going to get away with this crime. And I've always found that a very significant line in the film.
The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And if you are lucky enough to be right here in the UK, it's good news for you. In a Lonely Place is streaming right now. Often considered the greatest British film ever made, 1949's The Third Man mixes staple noir influences with artistic elements to brilliant effect. Joseph Cotten plays a frustrated novelist, Holly Munns, a new arrival in Vienna, a city ripped apart by war and Allied occupation. He's been promised a job by his childhood friend, Harry Lime, but immediately after arriving, it becomes clear that the name Harry Lime will quickly come to symbolise something quite dark indeed. Eddie, I don't want to give too much away, but the climax to this film, a tense chase through the sewers of Vienna with stark shadows cast all over the walls, it really is quite something magnificent, isn't it?
It's an extraordinary film. I think that some people would argue that it's like the perfect film, or the perfect film noir, if you want. But yeah, it is an exceptional movie. And it's, as you were describing that, it's so fabulous to me that there are people who will probably be seeing this film for the first time, which is something that, you know, I've come to learn and really appreciate. When I started programming films and trying to rescue films, I would not show things that were considered classics because I felt like everybody's seen this, you know, Double Indemnity and Out of the Past and The Third Man. And then recently I showed The Third Man to a packed house in San Francisco, and I realized that half the people in the audience or more had never seen this movie. And instead of feeling, you know, depressed about that, like, wow, what does that say about film culture in the world? It's very exciting to be able to spring something this tremendous on unsuspecting young people is a fantastic thing.
Now, while The Third Man may well be Britain's greatest achievement in the cinema, it's also become a cultural touchstone of sorts in Vienna. The great Austrian city plays as the ultimate setting, its European charm blending wonderfully with the scenes of a war-ravaged city captured perfectly by Robert Krasker's expressionistic black-and-white photography. The recent 4K restoration of the film highlights just how significant a place it holds, which will come as no surprise to Kurt Schrammeck. As the owner of Vienna's Burgkino Cinema, he maintains quite a special relationship with what must be the city's favourite film. Monocle's man in Vienna, Alexei Korolev, popped in for a chat.
I never knew the old Vienna before the war with its Strauss music, its glamour and easy charm. Constantinople suited me better. I really got to know it in the classic period of the black market. We'd run anything if people wanted it enough and had the money to pay.
Thus begins one of the greatest British films ever made, a 1949 thriller centered around a selfish American racketeer by the name of Lime, Harry Lime, played by Orson Welles, the eponymous Third Man. The film is set in post-war Vienna, Bonaparte a bit, and occupied by the four powers, but despite its decidedly international atmosphere, the Viennese have long since claimed it as their own. There's a Third Man tour, for instance, which will take you through the film's various locations, including into the sewers, the setting of its dramatic final scene. And at the iconic Burgkino, or Burg Cinema, on the Ringstrasse Boulevard, it's shown almost every day, alongside the latest foreign and Austrian productions.
Beginning from 1980, we are showing The Third Man, and at least 25 years we have got regular showings.
Kurt Schrammeck is the long-time owner of the Burgkino. He explains why The Third Man is so special to Vienna.
First, in 1980, it was quite common to make a reissue of a film. You could show films like The Third Man, also other film classics, for about 1, 2, 3 weeks. And of course, everything has changed since then. But The Third Man is a rare exception in this matter. I think it has to do with the fact that the film is some kind of document of the time when it was playing then and when it was made. It is quite unusual to make a film really on a place that can never be restored like it has been before. It is a film shot in the partly destroyed city a few years after the World War, and you can see in this film Vienna as it was, and you will never see again. I think the film also captures the very special mood of these years after the war. Vienna was divided into four parts by the occupying forces of the victorious nations, the life was far from normal. And when you see this film, and you know that it was shot in these surroundings, then you get a feeling of a time that can't be compared to any other films also shot in those times.
Mm. But then I understand the film is also very special to you personally, because you own the rights to it, don't you?
Yes, it was in the late 70s when I realized that nobody cared about this film. And I also had the impression that the Viennese population didn't really like the film, because the people, as they were shown in the film, it's not a very good impression that people in the film make. And so this might have been one of the reasons. And anyway, the film wasn't available for more than 10 years before, and I thought it would be important to show it again. A year before I became the owner of the Burg Cinema, I had a small cinema in a 7th district and my own distribution company, and I tried to get the rights, and then I made a reissue, and it was a sensation. The film has been shown for six weeks. It was an enormous success, which can't be compared to anything today. And of course, this success couldn't be repeated in the following years. But what has remained is enduring interest of the people to see this film.
So it's still economically viable to show this film every now and again?
As a matter of fact, it's not about economics. It's okay, and I think it's just a pleasure to give people the opportunity to see this film. It's more about the people who want to see this film here, and the economic basis is solid. That's it.
Monocle's Alexei Korolev there, dimming the lights at Vienna's Burkino Cinema with its owner, Kurt Schrammeck. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this short break.
After carving a small place in American pop culture as part of Nicholas Ray's 1955 drama Rebel Without a Cause, Dennis Hopper personified the nation's counterculture in 1969's Easy Rider. As he prepared to shoot his next movie, a personal project that would end in disaster, two filmmakers set out to discover the person behind the famed Hopper persona. What they found, however, was something else.
I don't see any difference between the young guys that we portrayed smuggling cocaine into the country, which is tax-free, and the examples their fathers had set for them by having munition plants and smuggling frozen funds out of the country and putting it in banks in Switzerland. I'm not sure which is a bigger criminal act.
Originally screened at film festivals across the US in 1971, The American Dreamer has been little seen ever since. Until now. From today, this remnant of Dennis Hopper's creative mind is screening for movie subscribers across the UK and in selected theatres. The American Dreamer, a fascinating insight into one of cinema's most elusive figures. Exclusive to Movie.
You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. I'm joined today by Eddie Meller at our New York bureau. He's an author and film historian among many other interests, and we're discussing film noir in light of MUBI screening the undisputed 1950 classic In a Lonely Place from director Nicholas Ray. But as we discussed at the top of the show, one of the greatest things about cinema is that there's really no end to the number of long-forgotten obscurities just waiting to be rediscovered. And I'm so pleased that we get to discuss one of those now, 1949's Too Late for Tears.
What's the matter, Jane?
I tried to tell you before we left home. I just don't like being patronized, that's all. I don't think I could take another evening of it.
Patronized? Oh, sweetheart, Ralph is one of the nicest guys.
No, it isn't Ralph. This diamond-studded wife, looking down her nose at me like a big ugly house up there looks down on Hollywood. Please, I'm just not going. Slow down, find a place to turn.
Oh, Jane, you're crazy. Alice likes you.
Please, Alan, I mean it. I'm just not going.
Eddie, I first discovered this film after digging through a cheap and nasty bargain bin at a Target department store in a small Australian country town many years ago now. I bought it as part of one of those cheap little box sets filled with random public domain films of very varying quality. Now, I knew nothing about the film itself or even film noir when I started watching it, and yet instantly I was hooked on both the film and its marvellous star, Elizabeth Scott. I mean, there is something quite magnetic about the way this film plays out, isn't there?
Absolutely. I find it amusing that Too Late for Tears was like your gateway drug to film noir. That's fantastic.
I had a very good
introduction. There's always one, and everybody always remembers their first, you know? It's like, oh my God, Liz Scott. Oh, it is pretty amazing. And it's just an example of one of those films that can just disappear. I mean, we could talk for hours about how that happens and how independently made films of that era did not have the protection of a big studio if they were not, you know, owned by the studio, which was the case with this film. And so for years, despite, you know, having such a great and witty and fun screenplay and great performances by these magnetic stars, as you say, Liz Scott and Dan Duryea is also tremendous in this film, it just slid away into obscurity. And the only way you could see it was exactly as you describe, on these really terrible public domain copies.
Let's just talk quickly about the film itself, because I do want to talk about Elizabeth Scott too, who's such a fascinating presence all of her own. But as we were saying, there is something about this film that is just so exciting, isn't there? Tell us about your thoughts on how the plotting, the pace, everything just comes together to create such an exciting experience.
Well, it has qualities, dare I say, of a farce almost, because it's so quickly paced. And it largely takes place in and around her apartment with all of these various men trying to coerce her into giving up this money that she's found. It's like the film noir version of No Country for Old Men, where Josh Brolin finds the satchel of money and it's like, what do I do with this? And Liz Scott is about as formidable as Javier Bardem, I think. And she's just not going to give this money up. That's all there is to it. And Roy Huggins, who wrote this, would go on to become one of the most successful independent writer producers in American television history. He created lots of famous television shows. But in this movie, he really has mastered the pace, the snappy dialogue, the actors just play it to a fare thee well. And it's just great fun. It's one of those noir films that, if you know, it's not like In a Lonely Place, which is a really deep artistic experience for me. This is fun. To me, the movie is just very snappy and fast-paced. And all the stuff you love about film noir, the chatter, the wisecracks, all that, you get it in spades in this film.
Eddie Muller, thank you very much for joining me on The Cinema Show today. And that's it for this week's show. I hope we've inspired you to dig through the treasure chest of cinema history, whether it's a Bogart classic or a B-movie obscurity, and perhaps even discover your own long-forgotten gem. Now, don't forget that In a Lonely Place is streaming on Movie in the UK right now. And being Valentine's weekend, you can also catch the romantic classic It Happened One Night, fantastic film, and the cult favourite Harold and Maude. And if you're in the US, we haven't forgotten you, the wonderful French comedy Amelie is heading your way. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yulian Goffin. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, or of course subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch with me, just send me an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.